It is a State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the inner workings of the fake elector scheme in Wisconsin and the plot that Donald Trump's campaign used in vain to try to overturn President Joe Biden's 2020 victory here. More than 1,400 newly released documents by Republican operatives give insight into the scheme's origin story here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rich Kramer is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter who has been poring over these documents in recent days. Rich, welcome back to the Ideas Network. We're having just...
I am so sorry about that. Thanks for having me, Kate. It's good to be back.
Get off of that mute, Rich.
I was smashing that mute button. Sorry.
That's okay. Let's start with former Trump attorneys Jim Troupas and Kenneth Chesbro, who shared these documents and their text messages and their emails and other types of documents. What is new in these pieces, in these documents?
Really, it's a fuller understanding of how this all went down and how it started in Wisconsin. This state really was the genesis of what's become known as the false elector plot used by the Trump campaign in hopes of overturning his loss to President Biden back in January 2020. So Chesbro first pitched the idea to Attorney Jim Troupas days after the November election in 2020. At first, Chesbro was saying having Republicans pose as presidential electors was about ensuring that Trump electors would be counted if the former president won in court. You know, there were a lot of lawsuits challenging the results in Wisconsin and other states. So if the court said, you know what, Trump, you won, that way they would have their electors counted in Congress. But a month later, Chesbro told Troupas that having alternate slates of electors would pay huge dividends, even if there wasn't any litigation pending. Also, what's new is official Wisconsin electoral ballots and certifications from Trump's 2016 victory here were used as templates to draw up these false elector ballots and certificates used in Wisconsin and other states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, New Mexico. And the two attorneys were really frustrated with conservative Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Brian Hagedorn when he sided with the court's liberals at the time to reject a Trump lawsuit seeking to overturn the election. Troupas said that in a text message to a Trump campaign person, Troupas said Hagedorn went full liberal equity. And while previewing an upcoming trip to the White House to talk to Trump, Chesbro joked with somebody, it's unclear who, but he said they were thinking of inviting Hagedorn on the plane and solving that problem at high altitude over water. So there's a lot of new little tidbits like that, but the big picture is it really gives a clear understanding of how this all started in Wisconsin.
Can you explain and step back how these documents came to light?
Yes, there. This latest tranche was released as part of a settlement. There was a lawsuit brought by some Democrats who were actual certified electors for Biden. They sued the fake Republican electors in Wisconsin. We've already had a settlement with the 10 Republicans who actually voted as electors. And this was kind of the final piece of that lawsuit. And this was a settlement with Troupas and Chesbro. So as part of the deal that they struck with the attorneys representing the Biden folks, the Democrats, they released all these documents.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about this his recent reporting on this trove of thousands of documents, over 1,000 documents related to Wisconsin's fake elector scheme. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Rich, these documents show the role of Jim Troupas in greater detail here in this scheme. And according to the documents, how did Troupas work to keep former President Donald Trump in power?
So Troupas was playing a pretty well-known role at the time. He was the Trump campaign's top lawyer in Wisconsin. And in that role, he was involved in the partial recount of ballots from Dane and Milwaukee counties. He also filed the lawsuit that asked with the Wisconsin Supreme Court to overturn Biden's win by tossing out more than 200,000 absentee ballots from or ballots from Milwaukee and Dane counties specifically. And Troupas was key in getting Chesbrough's false elector plot, the idea that Chesbrough had pitched early on, days after the November election back in 2020. He ran it up the ladder at the Trump campaign. So really, in short, the link, Troupas was the link between Chesbrough's vision with regard to the false electors and the campaign's enactment of the plan all the way up to Congress. So Troupas was communicating with top strategists in the Trump campaign about how important it was for Republican electors to vote on December 14th, 2020.
You say December 14th, and I want to revisit some Troupas audio. This is December 16th, 2020. Troupas testifying before the U.S. Senate hearing on election security and administration, saying he's honored to have served President Trump and blames Democrats for failing to be transparent about the election. Here's some of what he said.
One of the reasons people are doubting the election is because the other side here, the Biden campaign's primary defense is don't hear the evidence. Don't let them litigate. Don't have a court rule on the substance. Let's be honest, that's what's going on.
So what did Troupas' communications from that time reveal about whether he believed the election was stolen?
So it does match up with what he said at that hearing, but so I'd say earlier on in the emails and texts, Troupas seemed to suspect foul play by Democrats and some election officials. He and Chesbrough in exchanges were complaining about things like absentee ballot drop boxes, you know, a surge of voters declaring they were indefinitely confined due to the pandemic, the COVID pandemic at the time. And Wisconsin Elections Commission guidance for correcting absentee ballots, they were upset with that. There was a Democracy in the Park event in Madison that Chesbrough and Troupas were upset with. And a lot of those things made it into the lawsuit. But on December 7th, 2020, a week before the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled against Trump in that lawsuit that I was just referring to, Troupas focused more on the political angle of things, saying that sending alternate slates of electoral ballots to Congress, you know, it would be key to have it happen in multiple states, send in multiple slates of electors so the election, quote, remains in doubt until January.
You know, there's this memo from Trump lawyer Kenneth Chesbrough citing a 1960 dispute in Hawaii about whether to submit electors for Democrat John F. Kennedy or Republican Richard Nixon. Why did Trump's attorneys latch onto this case?
You know, I don't really know, but I do know it was like, it seems like the most recent example of both Democrats and Republicans casting electoral ballots for their preferred candidates on that day that we're talking about, the magic day, December 14th, outlined in the Constitution. So that happened in Hawaii amid a contested election and a recount, an ongoing recount. Those competing slates of electors were sent to Congress, and Nixon, who was presiding over the joint session of Congress certifying electoral ballots, called for the Kennedy electors to be certified by Congress, not his own. So that is, I mean, it's essentially the most recent example of something like this happening, but there are differences.
And those differences glaringly would be, go ahead.
Those differences are essentially that in Hawaii, it all happened in public. Both the Democrats and the Republicans casting their electoral ballots did it in the same room with newspaper reporters and cameras there. And in 2020, it was essentially, you know, these documents show that they wanted no press about it whatsoever. The Trump campaign did not want anyone talking about it. And even were unsure about putting out statements afterwards.
WPR reporter Rich Kramer there providing context for this trove of documents released last week as part of a legal settlement shedding new light on Wisconsin's role in the false elector plot by Trump's campaign in 2020. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about this trove of documents released through a lawsuit settlement, providing a more detailed glimpse of the plot that unfolded 5 days after President Biden was declared the unofficial winner of the 2020 election, and how the fake elector scheme in Wisconsin was a type of test model for other states in election meddling. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Rich Kramer with us, a WPR reporter. Let's go to Tom in Madison. Tom, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning, Kate. 2 points. The first point is all of this extra legal activity by Mr. Troupas and potentially other Wisconsin attorneys should be investigated by the Office of Lawyer Regulation here in the state of Wisconsin and by the State Bar of Wisconsin with a look to disbarring them from practicing in Wisconsin. But the main problem here is that the elephant in the room, the Electoral College, still exists. And the Electoral College, by its very nature, is undemocratic. Remember, those people get to vote twice. You don't and I don't, but they get to vote more than once on a presidential election.
Tom, thanks for calling in. On those 2 points, Rich, on the first, did the attorneys Chesbrough and Troupas get into trouble or have to pay fines through this suit?
Well, this settlement essentially ends with them admitting no liability or no culpability. That was the same outcome of the settlement between the actual Trump electors from Wisconsin and the folks that sued, the Democrats that sued. So in both cases, there was all these documents. The 10 electors in the previous suit said, look, we recognize that this, what we did was used by the campaign in attempts to overturn the election. But again, essentially admitting no fault or culpability in anything broader. Some people have wondered, you know, why the Wisconsin Department of Justice is not looking into or investigating these electors or Troupas or Chesbrough. But, you know, we've seen that happen in other states, charges in, I want to say, Michigan and other places. But just to this point, the Wisconsin Department of Justice and Attorney General Josh Call's office have essentially said, we're not going to, you know, even comment to whether there is or isn't an investigation, essentially mum. So as for the Office of Lawyer Regulation, State Bar, I suppose that's possible, but I have not heard any rumblings about that sort of thing happening as of yet. And it kind of reminds me of another situation. We had the election investigation headed up by former Supreme Court Justice Mike Gabelman, and a judge in Dane County did refer him to the Office of Lawyer Regulation for potential sanctions or at least for them to look into it. That process takes forever, and I have not heard whether the referral was even made yet.
In 2022, Congress made changes to the Federal Electoral Count Act that would essentially minimize the chances of a similar plot happening again. What have experts you've spoken with said about the impact of these changes?
So I talked to Ohio State University law professor Ed Foley, who's an expert, one of the several experts on the Electoral College and all the laws surrounding that. So he said that these changes in 2022 really clarify that the vice president's role during Congress's certification of electoral ballots is solely ministerial. That is, you're presiding over this. You cannot decide which ballots are accepted or rejected. The other changes also raised the number of lawmakers in the U.S. House and Senate that are needed to challenge electors. Before it was one in each house, now it's 20%. And the federal code that Chesbrough said in some of these documents that would allow the Wisconsin legislature to simply override the popular vote, that was also changed. So in a nutshell, Foley told me that these are as good a set of rules as anyone can write to provide clarity in what had been a vaguely written Electoral Count Act. But he told me the big caveat is rules exist on paper and human beings enforce them. Foley said, if rules aren't followed in the future, we're stuck with the, quote, fallibility of human beings.
Barb emailed to say these fake electors should be held accountable and be fined. Bob Spindell, Barb says, should be removed from the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Has there been any other beyond the Troupas and Chesbrough situation in the courts? Has there been other impacts to the actual fake electors, Rich Kramer?
There have been in other states. I mean, and let's not forget, even Chesbrough was charged with a felony. He was convicted of a felony in Georgia for filing false paperwork, essentially. And in Wisconsin, not that I know of. There was these lawsuits. They took a couple years. I mean, we're talking about today about a lawsuit settlement for a case that was first filed in 2022. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, that's the end of the line with regard to those suits. There could be other legal actions. I have no idea.
Rich Kramer with us, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, discussing this trove of over 1,000 documents related to Wisconsin's fake elector scheme. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So Trump lawyer Kenneth Chesbrough told lawyer Jim Troupas that the Republican-controlled state legislature could call the election for Trump. How would have that scheme worked?
Yeah, so in multiple emails, Chesbrough said that the U.S. Constitution requires each state to appoint presidential electors essentially the way they want, in such a manner as the legislature may direct. He said that means if the Wisconsin GOP-controlled legislature felt Democrats or liberal election officials didn't follow state law when conducting the popular vote, quote, the election just doesn't count, end quote. That was what Chesbrough said to Troupas. That was part of his idea. And he said that it would essentially give him two bites at the apple, litigate the case in court, and also try to convince enough lawmakers to order electoral votes go to Trump, regardless of the popular vote. And Chesbrough said, doing so doesn't disenfranchise voters. He also told Troupas, it's clear citizens have no right to vote for president.
What was their strategy in order to explain this scheme to voters, to the public? Did they have a public type of plan?
Yeah, so Chesbrough and Troupas worked on a fill-in-the-blank press release for Republicans in other states to explain why their electors were voting when Trump was behind in the popular vote. So that was interesting to find. But in short, they were saying, look, this vote happened on December 14th to maintain, to keep our options open in case a court decides that Trump won. That way, these electors would be certified or could be certified by Congress. But again, we knew that when those statements came out, internal documents already showed that Chesbrough said it doesn't matter what happens in the courts. Hmm. So it was really two kind of different approaches in public and in private.
I wonder, Rich, your sentiment on this. How could this information, this transparency, inform our current state of political affairs in America?
You mean the transparency regarding these new documents?
Yeah, these documents and just whether a scheme like this could play out again.
I asked Foley about that, Edward Foley of Ohio State, and essentially said, nothing's off the table, when you've got humans involved. So this informs, what happened was this this plot really went a long, long ways. I mean, it went all the way to January 6th. We saw the violence at the Capitol, and it was a, you know, it was a rough moment in American history. So that's on everybody's mind. It got Congress to make those changes in 2022. So that's a big change. But again, as Foley said, anything written on paper is only as good as the people enforcing it. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see. It was essentially the message I got from him.
Rich, thank you for your reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the legislative session wraps up, we check in on the work of the powerful Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee. Representative Tony Kurtz of Waniwak is a Republican who sits on the 16-member committee and represents Juneau County and parts of four nearby counties. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Kurtz, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate that.
Good morning. Yes, Governor Evers earlier this month vetoed most of a package of Republican bills that would change our state's tax brackets and expand tax breaks, including for retirement income. Just want to get your feedback. How do you feel about the governor's veto?
Well, I was a little disappointed, particularly in the retirement tax exclusion. Obviously, we gave four different tax packages to the governor in anticipation that he would probably pick and choose which ones he would sign. And obviously he did sign the to expand the child independent care expenses, and I'm happy he did that. The other ones would increase the marriage credit, also the second bracket, expanding that one. Mm-hmm. But the other one, like I just mentioned at the top of the moment, was the expansion of the retirement income tax exemption. You know, with I was at an event yesterday, and I know it was actually brought up to me yesterday by some retirees that basically asking me why, you know, why did the governor veto that specifically one? And to be honest with you, I don't know why he vetoed that one. It was disappointing because, particularly as you know, Kate, our state is aging, unfortunately, and I know that tax exclusion would have been very helpful for a lot of retirees on fixed incomes.
Are there other ways outside of tax cuts that would be helpful for retirees and appealing for working families?
Well, and I think that's where you're going to see, and I know later on we're going to talk about the future of the budget surplus, but I think you're going to see continuing attempts to lower the tax burden for Wisconsinites, particularly the thing that I focus on, to be honest with you, in my particularly assembly district is helping those on fixed incomes, the senior citizens. And so, you know, if we can do something with it, the tax exclusion in the future, or maybe more targeted to property taxes, I think that's something I think all, particularly those on fixed incomes, would be very open to and very, very happy to have.
When you mention property taxes, I wonder what type of vision do you have there? What type of savings do you see there?
Well, so the tax exclusion that we proposed that the governor vetoed, that could have been a savings up to approximately $1,500 for the average filer. And once again, that was only for, you know, somebody over the age of 65. So, for instance, if you had somebody that was retired from WRS, like I do, I have a retired school teacher near me named Tondra, that with this package that we put together, she could have saved about $880 per year on her income tax exclusion for her WRS retirement. I guess something like that to give some type of relief moving forward, particularly, you know, if it can't be something with tax exclusion, could it be something with some type of help for those over 65 for property taxes? Because that is one thing, to be very fair, that's something that I hear the majority in my district is the help with the property taxes and the increases that we've seen over the years.
Governor Evers had said he vetoed the tax cut proposal because the bills could have resulted in the state repaying, quote, billions of dollars in federal relief funds through the 2021 Federal American Rescue Plan Act. Do you agree that money would have had to be repaid?
Well, so your listeners, obviously, you have the listeners that follow what we do in Madison, but there's also there's a place called the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. Legislative Fiscal Bureau is a nonpartisan, and they're very respected, not only in the state, but also the country. We had a memo drafted from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau about 2 weeks ago that basically debunked that theory that It's virtually impossible that the federal government would ask for this money back. In addition, there's been precedents at different courts around the country that basically, once the federal government gave this money to states, it's by court precedents, they had not been repaid back. So I understand what the governor is saying, and to the average person not hearing the other side of the story, it would make sense. But the fact of the matter is that's simply not true. And like I said, we have a memo from Fiscal Bureau, once again, a nonpartisan group that says, nah, this is not going to happen.
Well, let's look at the piece that was greenlit, the child care tax credit. The governor last week approved the legislation and spoke in support of the bill during his radio address.
Simply put, the cost of child care in this state is too darn high. Making quality child care more affordable across Wisconsin is not just about doing what's best for our kids. It's also critical for keeping more folks and parents in our state's workforce, too.
Representative Kurtz, are child care costs too high in Wisconsin?
Well, I think child care costs is something, you know, I have two grown children now. They're in their 20s. And so, you know, 20 years ago when my wife and I were both working and paying child care costs, you know, at that time, I thought those were expensive. And yes, I mean, they are. If you want quality people taking care of your kids, it is going to cost money. And so I am glad, you know, of the four packages that we sent, obviously, as a Republican, I'd like him to sign all those. I wish he would have signed at least the retirement one. And I'm glad he did sign the child care, because I have a young couple in my area by the name of Travis and Sarah. They have two young, beautiful kids. They both work. They are paying child care expenses. And this right here, with the expansion of the child care tax credit, that's something that's going to save them probably roughly around $700 to $750 a year on their costs. So that's good. I mean, that's good for Sarah and Travis and a lot of our working families.
Talking with Republican Representative Tony Kurtz of Waniwak, a member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Colin, with a question, you can share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which estimates the state's budget will reach a more than $3 billion surplus by the start of the next two-year budget cycle. You know, you being a member of the Joint Finance Committee, how should the state use the budget surplus?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to maintain the strong financial position that we are in Wisconsin and our finances. Our state is in very good shape. As you mentioned, that $3 billion is kind of in our checking account, per se. And then the other thing that I hope your listeners understand, excuse me, we have $1.85 billion in a rainy day fund, mm-hmm. and that's our quote-unquote our savings account. And the interesting part about it is that in itself has an interest about $7.5 million every month that we earn interest on that. So financially, the state is in very good shape, and we need to maintain that, obviously, moving forward. The one thing I do want to stress to your listeners, you know, over the last several budgets, we have made a lot of good investments in infrastructure in the state, obviously roads, bridges, a lot of our building projects, which I know we're going to discuss about the engineering building here in a moment. But I think in the next budget moving forward, obviously, I think you're going to continue to see that trend to invest in our roads and bridges and buildings. But also, you know, as conservatives, we would like to give some of that money back. So I could see we would probably try something to some other tax package that hopefully the governor would support. And so I think that's what we're going to be moving forward, maintain our sound financial, but also make those key investments like we've been doing over the last several budgets.
Beyond tax cuts, is there any role for anything else when you're looking at a surplus as it stands?
Well, and this is where, you know, let's be honest. I've said this before on other radio programs, is I would like the governor to get a little bit more engaged in the negotiating process. You know, obviously you heard with the soundbite that you put on about his desire to, you know, help more with child care. You know, I could see I could support something like that. But in exchange, let's give a little bit more money back to Wisconsinites, i.e. like this retirement income tax, expanding the second bracket, which he has said in the past he has supported. So I hope next cycle we can be a little bit more creative, maybe have some discussion, some compromise, say, okay, Governor, you want more for child care. We want a little bit more for Wisconsinites through via, you know, tax returns, tax rebates. And I think that's where I hope we can find some common ground moving forward.
Common ground and compromises there. Let's move on to building projects. Last week, the governor approving UW system-wide capital project investments. And this measure includes spending money to construct a new engineering building on the UW-Madison campus, which legislative Republicans had rejected in the governor's capital budget. How do you feel about this building coming to fruition?
Oh, no, I'm excited. I'm excited for the UW system as a whole. Obviously, for, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the previous budget, we also put in approximately $75 million into the building program to basically help with the infrastructure of that building in the future. And so this is just another step in investment to the UW system. Engineering is a huge need in our state, not only our state, the country. And so I'm glad to see that it got across the finish line. And something like I mentioned a moment to you, Kate, the previous budgets, including this last budget, you know, we have made a lot of significant investments, not just roads and bridges, but also a lot of our buildings. The other part about this package is like Platteville, UW-Platteville. You know, there's two buildings that they would like to take down.
Mm-hmm.
This money that we allocated and the governor signed, that's going to actually pay for some buildings to be removed from the campus that, like, and that's system-wide. There's a couple other examples like that. But Platteville said, hey, these buildings are costing us money. We don't need them. Let's go ahead and demolish them. So I'm glad we got this across the finish line.
Let's take a call now. Chris in Milwaukee is here. Chris, hi.
Good morning. I have to say, I do not want to hear any more talk about tax cuts. People are voting to for referendum for schools because the state won't give enough money for schools. The prisons, we have all these prisoners, and the prisons are falling apart. We rival Mississippi at being at the bottom on so many scales. I don't know why we think that the best thing to do with the money in the state is to give it to the people who already have plenty. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Representative Kurtz, what is your response to that?
No, and that's a fair question. And the fact of the matter is, one of the things when we talk about the budget is to live within our means. So the last two budgets, for her example about K-12 education, the last two budgets, we have been at that standard that Governor Tommy Thompson so many decades ago mentioned about a two-thirds funding. That's a state portion. And we're at that. And I think that's something, and I can only speak for Assembly Republicans, you know, we're committed to that two-thirds funding from the state to our K-12 education. Now, remember, that other third has to come from communities. So, and one thing that I'm dealing with in my communities is declining enrollment, and that does hurt particularly a lot of schools. And so the schools, unfortunately, in my area, some of them are going to referendum because some of those do have declining enrollment in those areas. And she brings up a very good point about the prisons. Obviously, we have Green Bay and Waupun, which are max security prisons. The interesting part about those, if any of your listeners have ever watched the movie Shawshank Redemption, that's kind of what those two prisons looked like. They were made back in the 1800s. They're incredibly unsafe for our correctional officers. And to be fair, they're unsafe for our inmates. It's something that I think the state needs to have a really strong conversation about building a brand new prison and then utilizing that new prison by closing Green Bay and Waupun, because those two prisons, to her point, they are. They're falling apart, built in the late 1800s. It's time the state does something about those.
Representative Tony Kurtz, a Republican from Waniwak, as we discuss Wisconsin politics and legislative priorities. Colin, with a question, you can add your thoughts, 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the end of a legislative session, we reflect on policy priorities and proposals to support military veterans. We'll take a look at there. You can join the conversation and add your thoughts. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Representative Tony Kurtz, a Republican from Waniwak. Representative Kurtz, you are co-authoring a bill that would better support employees of veterans' homes and amend requirements for veterans' cemetery burials and improve the Wisconsin Code of Military Justice regarding sexual assault. Can you explain these measures?
Yeah, that's Assembly Bill 1079. And some of you may or may not. Obviously, we have quite a few veterans' homes in our states, particularly Union Grove and King. And like a lot of locations, particularly in the medical field and the nursing home space, we need employees. And there's a lot of staff shortages at King and Union Grove. So one of the ideas is, since those are state-owned, those are state employees, and so they need to go through the state civil service system. So what this bill would do is basically bypass some of those requirements. So nursing staffs would still have to graduate from a Wisconsin school, would still have to have all the credentialing and licensing, but they wouldn't have to go through the civil service process, and hopefully would speed that process up to get much-needed nurses aides, CNAs, things like that, into our nursing home to help with the veterans' care. The other aspect, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was wondering on that point, are government VA facilities able to compete with the private sector that can increase pay rates quickly and perhaps be more nimble with their staffing?
Well, and this is one of the things that's interesting you brought that up. The last budget, we actually did go in and did a very specific targeted raises for those folks working in the veterans' home. So we have increased those targeted. Now, could we do more moving forward? Absolutely. This is more for the hiring process on how we try to get more people in the door to work in those facilities.
Should there be like a national staffing standard for these nursing homes and these facilities serving veterans? Do you see that in sight?
Well, obviously, you have the federal VA care.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, with DVA and the Department of Veterans of in the Wisconsin, I think our standards as far as what they're requiring right now, I think those are fine. It's just there's a shortage. And if somebody can try to get them in the door with still having the standards, still having, all the credentialing, but not necessarily going through the civil service hiring process, I think that's worth a try to see if we can increase that and boost that staffing level in our veterans' homes.
Would it impact care at all to veterans?
Not that we are aware of. And obviously, I'm a retired military veteran. My mm-hmm. wife's a veteran. And the last thing I would ever do is jeopardize any care for our veterans. So they deserve the best care. And so I do not believe this is going to reduce care for them. Once again, it has to be somebody from a Wisconsin school. They still have to have the exact same credentialing, et cetera. It's just they're not going through the civil service process. Just try this and see how that works to get much needed staff in those veterans' homes.
Can you explain the other ramifications of this bill?
Also, the other part of this, due to federal law, for the cemeteries around the country, you can't discriminate based on residency. Mm-hmm. So, you know, before somebody to be laid to rest in a Wisconsin veterans cemetery, they had to be a Wisconsin resident. This bill also would say, okay, from now on, you do not have to be a resident. Once again, we're just complying with a federal standard that's coming down that has to take effect, I believe, January of 2025. So we're just complying with the feds on this for our and it's interesting, there is shortages of veteran cemeteries around the country. And so I think this is a way for the feds to try to get more veterans that deserve that burial right into a military cemetery.
And the last piece of it on the Wisconsin Code of Military Justice regarding sexual assault.
So that little piece there, so two summers ago, well, last summer, I was the chair of a study committee on the sexual harassment and sexual complaints that the Wisconsin National Guard had from a study from 2019. And we put a couple bills together this past session. The governor signed those bills. This little tweak was something that there was a drafting error in one of the bills. And all this does is bring back, it inadvertently omitted a little statute, and that was never the intent. So this actually just brings that statute back into the state law. So it was an overdraft mistake on the drafting.
Republican Representative Tony Kurtz with us of Waniwak, a member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Coming full circle here on taxes, last month the Assembly passed a bill that would allow more veterans and their surviving spouses to claim a veterans tax credit, and you voted in support of this bill. Can you tell us about that?
So right now, currently in the state of Wisconsin, if you have a veteran who's 100% disabled, he or she can get a rebate on their property taxes. Mm-hmm. The bill that we passed in the Assembly that gave a lot of credit to Representative Edmund, that would bring that threshold down to 70%. So if you had a veteran, he or she that had a 70% disability, they now could apply to up to, you know, 70% to have a rebate for their property taxes as well. It also, to have a little, to get some compromise, we brought the income as far as the property value about down to $350,000. So if your home was $350,000 and below, then up to that part is what property taxes would be exempt for you, and you'd get that rebate. So obviously, if you have a $1 million home, you're not going to get that above the $350,000.
But that would make an impact on these veteran families.
Oh, absolutely. And to your point, I have quite a few friends that are disabled, and the vast majority of them are 100%. I have a few that are 90%. So this is something that would definitely help them make it more affordable.
Representative Kurtz, thank you for joining us.
No, I appreciate you having me on, Kate, and I hope you and all your wonderful listeners have a wonderful day.
Yeah, you too. Republican Representative Tony Kurtz of Waniwak, member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Kurtz is a farmer and a military veteran. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore generations of work by the Stockbridge Muncie Community Band of Mohican Indians in Wisconsin to reclaim artifacts and create a tribal archive, and how the process of amassing and organizing this collection strengthens tribal sovereignty. Be part of this discussion about protecting tribal history. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rose Myron is director of the Darcy McNichol Center for American Indian and Indigenous Studies at the Newberry Library in Chicago. New book is called Indigenous Archival Activism, Mohican Interventions in Public History and Memory. Rose, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So as a non-Mohican and non-Native historian and archivist, how have you come to understand your role in telling the tribe story here?
Yeah, absolutely. I really see my role in the process as carrying out tribal priorities and working as closely as possible with tribal members to make sure that the story is told accurately. I have been working with the community since 2010, so for the last 14 years. And really since the beginning, it's just been about making sure that this story is told because it's such a captivating and important story, and making sure that telling that story was something that the tribe was interested in.
You were a collaborator in so many ways through your work with the Mohican Nation. I mean, how has that enabled a more accurate telling, more accurate information, and perhaps less likely to do harm?
I think, you know, in many ways. I would say, you know, first of all, the archive in Boulder, Wisconsin at the R.B.D. Miller Library Museum is the largest collection of Mohican materials in the world. So I think, you know, first and foremost, if you're somebody who is doing research related to the Stockbridge-Munsee Mohicans, you have to go there because that's going to be where the majority of your sources would be. And it's where the majority of sources that are produced by Mohican people would be. So I think, you know, first and foremost, just showing up, being on the reservation, doing research in that space is just so important. And I think that being in that space really naturally creates opportunities for collaboration. You know, it was staff at the Library Museum when I first came to the archives and started doing work. I was originally there to watch a video series that I had heard about. And it was really staff there that said, hey, you know, we have this larger archive that you might be interested in looking at. And it was at their encouragement that I even started to look at those records and to understand that this oral history project that I had originally heard about was really part of this much larger recovery and reclamation project. And I think, you know, just to return to your question about accuracy, there were so many cases where I came across things in the archives and kind of brought them to tribal members, talked about them with them, and was, you know, they were able to shed more light on things that I just never would have had knowledge about, whether that was, you know, things related to their ancestral homelands or, you know, oral traditions that have been passed through generations. They were really able to just bring light to some of these archival records in a way that you could never get by only looking at those sources. And then lastly, I'll just say that, you know, some of the stories of this work I have found doesn't always live in archives. You know, there was a situation rather late in the book's process, actually, where one of the historical committee members was reading one of the chapters specifically about language revitalization, and she noticed that there was a lot missing that she had been involved in. And that's because her involvement in the process didn't really show up in the archives, but we were able to sit down, have a conversation, and revise that chapter together so that it really accurately represented what had happened.
Rose Myron with us, author of the new book, Indigenous Archival Activism, as we explore the work of the Stockbridge-Munsee Mohican community. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. There was a 2015 show for PBS Wisconsin where Kimberly Veely, is a member of the Stockbridge-Munsee Mohican community, spoke about efforts by tribal members to write their own history, which started at a conference in New York.
But it was really important, I think, for the history committee to make corrections to some of the record and to really tell the story from our perspective. Because, I mean, it's our history.
It's our history. How have European settlers and their descendants tried to control Mohican history and knowledge, Rose?
Well, I think this really stems from the you know, I think that the desire to control Native history is really as old as colonization itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see really early on in colonial records that prominent folks who, some of whom are thought of as founding fathers, were really calling on people to collect information about Native histories and Native languages and Native cultures. Thomas Jefferson famously was very interested in Native people and Native languages. Roger Williams is another person in that early era who really urges people and really takes part in the collection of Native languages. And I think that then as removal starts to happen, it's very convenient for European settlers to, you know, be able to say, well, these people just disappeared, because then it removes blame from them for living on these lands and for forcibly forcing these people to leave. So I think we see those erasure narratives take hold really early, really almost as removal is happening, as a way to take away blame from settlers who are now living on Mohican lands. And certainly for the Mohicans, this most famously happens through James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, which is, you know, what Ojibwe historian Jean O'Brien would call a lasting narrative. And it's right in the title there. It's all about, you know, saying that these people are the last of a group so that white settlement can move in.
How has the tribe responded to the depiction of their people in the book and in the film?
Well, I think they have constantly really tried to push back against it. I mean, really, when the historical committee was founded in the late 1960s and when this kind of reclamation project really took off in the early 1970s, in those early meeting minutes and in that correspondence, you really see historical committees referring to the Last of the Mohicans myth frequently, because they are conscious of it. They are addressing it, and they want people to know that it's false. And so, you know, as they start to coordinate trips back to their ancestral homelands, they're contacting newspapers, they're contacting other libraries. They're really trying to make their presence obvious as a way to push back against that myth. And then you see it, you know, really obviously in other places, you know, through the 2000s, especially after the movie comes out. You know, there are letters related to a curriculum project that came out of New York State, where the historical committee responds directly and says, you know, we are really sad to say that we don't think this curriculum, you know, addresses our history properly and instead is really in line with this tradition of the Last of the Mohicans. So I think they are very much aware of it. And, you know, throughout the history of what I have seen from the historical committee, it's something that they are really wanting to address head on and dispel.
Let's take a call now. Alicia is here in Milwaukee. Hi, Alicia.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can. Go ahead.
So I was just wondering, I had a couple of questions. One about the byline. As you collaborated, as your guest collaborated with the people of that community, did he give them like a byline and the authoring of this text?
How did those acknowledgements work, Rose?
That's a great question. This is something that the historical committee and I talked about really early. And again, you know, we worked really hard to collaborate throughout the process. So originally I was looking at this oral history series, and it was really at the urging of historical committee members that I started to look at other parts of the archive. And then we talked about, you know, this larger archival project. And at the time I was just starting, I hadn't applied to graduate school yet. And so I said, you know, I'm kind of interested in going to graduate school and getting a PhD. And I think it would be really interesting to write a history of this work. And the historical committee members were really excited about that. They agreed. They were excited about having some kind of history about all of the work that they had been doing for the last 50 years. And we talked lightly about, you know, whether or not there would be a co-author. And it didn't seem like that format really made sense. There was nobody really who was interested at the time in doing that. And so instead, we just agreed to have a really collaborative relationship in which I continued to update the historical committee on the progress of the book, that I brought them drafts, that I made sure that I was asking permission from both them and the tribal council before anything was published. And we worked to make sure that there was that kind of shared authority. And then as anything related to the book was produced, so for instance, like the oral histories that I conducted for the book at the urging of the historical committee members, I worked really closely with the legal department of the tribe to ensure that like I waived my copyright on those immediately and that the tribe has control of those stories. So we didn't talk about a co-author situation extensively, but we did work really hard to make sure that a collaborative and reciprocal process was set up.
Alicia, thanks for the question. We have archivist and historian Rose Myron. New book is called Indigenous Archival Activism, examining how members of the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican community in Wisconsin went about building a tribal archive. Call in with a question. Share thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the history and tribal identity of the Stockbridge Muncie community in Wisconsin and the tribe's determination to build an archive and reclaim documents and artifacts scattered around repositories in other states. The new book is called Indigenous Archival Activism, and it's by Rose Myron of the Newberry Library in Chicago. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Rose, you start the book in 1968, and there's a fire that has broken out in the home of Bernice and Arvid Miller in Boulder, Wisconsin. And the Millers had collected many historical records over the decades. What grew out of that collection and you know, that was saved from the fire?
Yeah, so as far as I know, there were no casualties of the fire in terms of people or in terms of documents. Neighbors actually broke a window in the home and rushed in and carried all of the documents out. All of the materials were relocated to kind of an army tent outside of Bernice Miller's home until a safe space could be set up for them. And then they were eventually moved over into a building that the tribe was no longer using. So it was really fortunate that so many neighbors were ready to, you know, go in and help. And I think it really just speaks to how important that archive was to community members and still is.
You said that Bernice Miller was nicknamed the Gatherer. Can you just explain how much work they did to try to amass these historical records that were really scattered?
Yeah, absolutely. So Bernice and her sister, Dorothy Davids, and Bernice's daughters, especially Leah, Sheila, and Molly, and then other early members of the historical committee, really right away after the fire began to sort of plan and think about, you know, what should we do with these documents? Bernice and Arvid, before his death, had long dreamed of having a library and archive and museum. And the fire really just was sort of the you know, literal spark that pushed them to make that happen. They really carried on work that Arvid had already started. Arvid served as the tribal chairman between 1941 and 1968. And during that time, he often traveled across the nation for business related to his role. And, you know, when he would go to Washington, D.C., he would go to the National Archives. And if he was going to go out to the Northeast, you know, he would stop in Boston, he would stop in Stockbridge, and he would start to, you know, physically transcribe these records. A lot of the work that he did was before the invention of copy machines. So he was literally handwriting and copies of these documents.
Wow.
And so some of that, yeah. So some of that was what was carried out of Bernice's home. But then Bernice and her sister and all the other members of the historical committee really made a strategic plan essentially for, you know, what to do next and what archives they had not yet gone to. So, you know, they made lists of different places. There are tons of letters in the collection written by Bernice where she's just reaching out to archives and asking for information, saying, you know, do you have any information you can share with me? She and historical committee members also start making trips out to the Northeast to physically go into these archives and to look for information. And they're continuing that process of copying materials and bringing them back to the reservation and then reassembling them in their own collection.
Well, here in Wisconsin, we might not think or know that the Stockbridge-Munsee community has these origins in the Northeast because we've always thought of them as a tribe here in Wisconsin. Can you explain a little bit about how they came to Wisconsin?
Sure, absolutely. So Mohican homelands are sort of around both sides of the Mahicanatuck or the Hudson River throughout the states of New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, kind of that area. And really, again, you know, they are the people who like met Henry Hudson on the shores of you know, what is now New York when he came to the United States. And so as colonialism was, you know, occurring in those early decades of, you know, the 18th century, especially, ultimately there was more and more white settlement that was happening. And so Stockbridge leaders came together and they decided to accept a mission at Stockbridge, which is, you know, the city of Stockbridge, Massachusetts. At the time, Stockbridge was not called Stockbridge, it was called Monadicook, which was a village for Mohican people. But they really saw this as an opportunity to have their children educated. And they saw, you know, that increasingly as white settlers were encroaching on their lands, that they thought that their best option was to work with these people. And so, you know, that mission was started. But then, of course, as soon as that was happening, they were increasingly pushed out of that land. Mm-hmm. You see, you know, white settlers in Stockbridge are excluding them from town meetings. They were, you know, preventing them from holding any kind of representation. And they sort of slowly and slowly dispossess Stockbridge people from that land until there is really no more land for them to live on. And they are forced to leave. And so at that point, in 1783, they moved to upstate New York to live alongside Oneida people and Brotherton people. And you'll see, you know, those three groups sort of move together and all end up in Wisconsin as New York, then the New York State, you know, forces Native people to leave. So Mohican people come in kind of a number of different routes. They're not like all, they don't all necessarily come together, but there's multiple different routes in which they're pushed out. And by about 1822, they mostly end up in what is now the city of Kaukauna. But again, there are a number of more dispossessions after that, right? They get pushed in the 1830s to what is now the east side of Lake Winnebago. And then they signed the Treaty of 1856, which puts them up in Shawano County. But even after that, there's multiple types of dispossession that make their land base smaller and smaller. And it's really not until 1936 that they move on into what is now the reservation.
Rose Myron, new book, Indigenous Archival Activism. Let's bring in Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi.
Yes, good morning. I have a niece in who is a professor at Marquette University, and she worked as a Jesuit volunteer at the St. Charles Mission in Pryor, Montana. And when she came back from that mission work, she discovered that there were archives in Marquette for the Absaluka Reservation. And she talked about how complex it was when she approached the elders, because there are some communities that really don't want those archives back because of the emotional trauma related to the archives. I wondered if your guest could speak to that.
Jane, thanks. Rose.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. I personally haven't encountered communities not wanting records back. I can say that in the case of Marquette, I don't know for sure, but I would guess that the records that your niece encountered were probably especially related to interactions between the community and the Catholic Church, just knowing, you know, the nature of that collection, and probably especially boarding schools. And of course, Indian boarding schools are an extremely difficult topic for a lot of people. And those are histories that I have encountered people who don't want to discuss. discuss and are not interested in, you know, bringing up a lot of that trauma. And yet there are also national efforts to do just that, to really promote healing. You know, the National Native American Boarding Healing, sorry, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, where I used to work, that was really, you know, that is a really big part of their goal, is to make the archival records of Indian boarding schools, including those at Marquette, more available to survivors and their descendants so that they can begin the healing process. That said, I think, you know, the goal of that coalition, and I think the goal of really any archive, should be to just make the materials accessible so that communities can decide how or if they want to engage with them.
We're going to pause right there with Rose Myron. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How do archives shape what we think about a particular people or aspect of history? We learn about the work of recovering, reclaiming, and representing the history and culture of the Stockbridge-Munsee community in Wisconsin. Author and historian Rose Myron uses the term Indigenous Archival Activism, which is the title of the book. Call in with a question. You can add your insights at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Rose, you write that the three elements of Indigenous archival activism are access, sovereignty, and new narratives. How do the tribal narratives fill the gaps and counter the historical accounts that were largely written by colonial settlers?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Kate. So I think you see the new narratives that are being created by members of the Stockbridge-Munsee community, both filling gaps where there just isn't information, where information has just simply been left out, as well as really reinterpreting things that have already been written. So misrepresentations or histories that do not accurately portray the history of the Stockbridge-Munsee people. And I think, you know, those new narratives really stretch across this archival project. Again, just to go back to Arvid Miller, when he was first working on doing a lot of the compiling of archival records, as he was writing, transcribing these records verbatim, he was also creating his own new narratives by putting multiple sources together and including his own experiences. So there's this really wonderful document in the archive written by him called On Christianity, and it's all about the history of Christianity among Stockbridge-Munsee Mohican people. And so he is really, you know, engaging with these old colonial sources, as well as his own experiences in, you know, colonial education, and writing a new narrative of that time to challenge previous narratives. So I think it's important to see both the kind of just new information that comes from things like oral histories and from these, you know, the records of how the Library Museum was founded, these records written by Bernice Miller, to also narratives that just directly challenge more contemporary museum exhibits and, you know, academic books that are coming out.
Hmm. You mentioned oral histories, and starting in the 70s, the Stockbridge-Munsee Historical Project recorded these extensive interviews with tribal elders. What information do these first-person narratives capture and convey?
Well, I think they capture a very wide array of information. I mean, in many cases, you have elders who are mostly talking about their own lives and their own experiences, which are, you know, just, of course, really, really rich narratives. A lot of the folks who were interviewed for the Hear Our Stories project that happened in the early 2000s were people who went through the mission school system, you know, near the Stockbridge-Munsee Reservation. And so they are sharing stories of their time in those institutions. Many of them served in the military, so they're sharing experiences of prejudice that they experienced in the military. And of course, many of them are active today in tribal politics, in the Historical Recovery Project. And so they're sharing really important information that will be important to future generations. However, I think one of the things that shows up in the oral histories is that you also have people who are talking about, you know, historical, their ancestors and how their how that influences their lives today, which I think is really interesting, and just gives such a perspective on how that history impacts people. The interview that really sticks out for me is an interview that Faye Church did. And she really begins her oral interview in 1677 with the birth of her ancestor, who is kind of colloquially known as King Ben, who is a Mohican leader. And then she kind of moves through Mohican history, talking about her perspective on all of those things. And I think that that's a really good example of how this knowledge allows us to see these historical events in a new light with a Stockbridge Munsee perspective.
And you also tell us about how when tribal members interview fellow tribal members, you know, the impact of the oral histories, they change. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I think that, you know, as I think anybody would be, folks are just a little bit more comfortable when they're talking to people that they know, when they're talking to somebody who they're familiar with. But I think it's also just a matter of the kinds of questions that are being asked by tribal members. You know, the oral histories are done in a way that they are for tribal audiences primarily, and the people who are engaging in their interviews know that, and they know that whatever responses they're giving are really going to be for future generations of their own community. I think in traditional oral history projects, they can be very extractive, right? In which you have these folks who are outside of the community coming in, asking questions that are about their own interests that have not been informed by community interests. And then they're taking those interviews and they're depositing them in some archive far away from the community, and they're using them for their own scholarship, but that doesn't benefit the community in any way, and it replicates these extractive processes. That's not, you know, a reciprocal, responsible relationship. And so I think when tribal members interview tribal members, that is just so vastly different, because it's about, you know, making sure that this information is recorded and made accessible to community members. And there's just a shared understanding of, you know, what information is important for future generations.
Rose Myron with us, author of the new book, Indigenous Archival Activism. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with the question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Rose, in 1989, the passage of Act 31 requires Wisconsin public schools to teach about the history and the culture, the sovereignty of the 11 federally recognized American Indian nations and tribal communities in our state. How has that curriculum requirement raised awareness of the contributions of tribes? What has been the impact?
So I think that Act 31 was a really great effort in a lot of ways. It's really, I think it's incredibly important for students across Wisconsin to understand the both the history and the fact that all of these nations in Wisconsin, the 11 federally recognized tribal nations in Wisconsin, still exist. And also to really understand treaty rights and sovereignty rights. Many of your listeners probably know that Act 31 really came out of conflicts related to folks exercising their treaty rights to fish and hunt on ceded land. And so I think that such one of the biggest misunderstandings about Native people is that folks think that they are just another racial group in the United States, and that's not true. American Indian nations have specific political sovereign status, and they have a special relationship with the federal government. And so members of those communities also have specific rights that are dictated in treaties that they signed with the federal government. And for folks in Wisconsin, that includes rights to fish on land that was ceded. And so I think part of Act 31 was really, the goal was to teach treaty rights and to teach sovereignty. I think as we have seen across the nation in many similar efforts, I think the kind of pitfall of the law is that it did not come with the kind of funding that would support teachers to get the kind of training that they need to teach that history accurately and well. I cannot speak to how the law was, you know, implemented across the state, and I'm sure that there are lots of people that had different experiences that I did. But as somebody who went to Wisconsin public schools, I can tell you that I never learned about the Native nations in Wisconsin. I did not learn about treaty rights. I did not learn about sovereignty until I got to college. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, you know, I definitely didn't get the education that Act 31 sought out to provide, but that doesn't mean that other people across the state didn't. And I want to say, you know, I think teachers are, you know, overworked and underpaid. And I think many of them just didn't know how to, and maybe still don't know how to teach that history. And so they just don't, out of fear of not doing it well, because they're just, we just don't have the support for them when they are in school to teach them about this history in a way that would enable them to teach it well to their students. That said, you know, the Stockbridge Muncie community did create a curriculum that was specifically related to Act 31. And I know that that curriculum was implemented, especially, you know, in schools around the reservation. And, you know, I personally haven't done like data collection around that, but I would take a guess that it has had a major impact for the communities that did see that curriculum. You know, having looked at it myself, at the very least, like anybody who went through that would at least come away with an understanding that Stockbridge Muncie people exist today. They did not disappear, and that they have a vibrant community and culture that they continue to, you know, engage with today.
Let's bring on another call now. Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, I joined late, but my question is, there's also emotional content when you're interviewing people or when you're looking through documents. And right now in our culture, there's a great wave of emotion within this nation to characterize people who come here as invaders and sort of destroyers of all that's good. I'm wondering if in the interviews or in the documents, there's any evidence that these people, much smaller groups of people actually, have that kind of rhetoric in their memory of what was being done to them, the emotional content.
The trauma. Rose, go ahead.
Sure. I do think that in both the interviews and in writings that I've seen, tribal members do talk about trauma that has been carried through generations that they continue to experience. One of the places that I've seen this show up the most is in records related to returns to ancestral homelands. One of the things that the historical committee did on several of the trips that they led to their homelands in the Northeast with other tribal members was hand out journals and ask tribal members to record, you know, what they were feeling, what they were thinking, what their experiences of those trips were. And something that you see in those journals is that people will really both feel an incredible amount of joy as well as a lot of pain. You know, those emotions show up together, and people are, you know, in general, you can see in their writings are so excited to go back to these lands. They feel like they, you know themselves and that their identities are being felt in new ways by returning to the homelands that their ancestors were removed from. And they're also then, you know, feeling that removal, and they're feeling that pain that their ancestors experienced all over again in many ways. And it leads to this, you know, very complex set of emotions for people as they are experiencing that. So I think that's where I've seen it show up the most.
Do you have any tips for museums or repositories that contain these really difficult records and artifacts for how they could be more trauma informed?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great question. So I think that, you know, first of all, just acknowledging that some of these records have traumatic materials in them. One of the things that we at the Newberry have been working on is trying to identify materials in the collection that have culturally sensitive information. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that just includes information that isn't necessarily traumatic, but is just like culturally sensitive in the sense that it should either only be seen by tribal members or it should only be seen in certain contexts. So for example, there are many tribal nations who have protocols around engaging with things that relate to death and burials. And so we want to make sure that, you know, somebody isn't inadvertently coming across, let's say, an image of a burial that they are not ready to come across or they don't want to come across because of their protocols. So one of the things that we are doing is trying to locate instances like that in the collection and flag those materials as culturally sensitive so that folks can make a decision about whether or not they want to look at those materials or not, and they have a heads up about that. So I think you're seeing many libraries across the nation start to implement these kinds of policies. In 2007, there was a document published called the Protocols for Native American Archival Materials, which is really kind of the leading guidance for libraries, archives, and museums that hold Native archival materials right now. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the suggestions that they make, is to, you know, try to flag these materials where possible. So that is, as much as possible, Native folks who are coming into the collection can make a decision about whether or not they want to see those materials or not. Mm. And there are, you know, other archives across the country that are starting to do this work as well. Another thing that I think is just really important, that I think is really still in progress at a lot of places, is to be able to provide space for people to step away if they want. There's some really great examples of Indigenous archives that have done this, that have created rooms for people to, you know, step away to, you know, smudge if they want to, or, you know, just take some time for themselves. And I think that it's really Indigenous archives that are leading the way on that. And that I hope that, you know, other non-Native archives will soon follow by creating those spaces for people.
Rose Myron, our guide to how a tribal nation in Wisconsin goes about reclaiming its history and challenging dominant white narratives in the process. The book is called Indigenous Archival Activism. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A tribe in Wisconsin uses archives to change the way both Native and non-Native people encounter and interpret Indigenous history and tribal sovereignty. We explore historian Rose Myron's scholarship on Indigenous tribal activism. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rose, I want to make space for women as rememberers. Women have been the majority of the members of the Stockbridge-Munsee Historical Committee. And just how significant a role have these women had in remembering and preserving the stories of their people?
They've had a huge role in that process. You know, really from the time the Historical Committee is founded in the late 1960s, it's almost entirely women who are, you know, doing the work of traveling to these archives, contacting archives, trying to reclaim these materials, working in the departments that the tribe has since created for this kind of work, the Tribal Historic Preservation Office, the Department of Cultural Affairs. It has been primarily women who are doing that work. And I think that, you know, prior to the 1960s, the people who we have on record doing this kind of similar work of recording and remembering the history of the Stockbridge-Munsee Mohican people has, from the archives, been historically men. But again, I think this is a really good example of, you know, what information perhaps lies beyond the archival record and can be learned by talking with people. You know, there's another historian, her name is Callie Kosk, who has done some work on earlier decades of Mohican women. And one of the things that she has found is that there are women who were primarily responsible for ensuring the protection of sacred sites as removal was going out. Mm-hmm. So there's a Mohican woman named Mary Peters who stayed behind as her people were being removed to ensure the protection of sacred sites. And then I think as you talk with women, you know, as I've talked with the women on the Historical Committee over the years, one of the things that I have also heard them stress is the role that women have long played historically in the role of both educating other members of the tribe as well as in language preservation. And I think those are both really key parts of the Historical Committee's work. So I think it's really possible, and I suggest in the book that women have long been a part of the remembering and the historical recording process, but that they just are not recorded as being part of that because of the ways in which women are often written out of historical records.
Let's take another call, John in Appleton. John, go ahead. Hey,
Hello, Rose.
Oh, there you go. Go ahead, John.
What do you feel is the current and future status of the Mohican tribe? And are they thriving? And is there a new generation of young people wanting to keep their ancestry a proud part of their heritage and keep things like language and traditions of the tribe alive?
Thank you, John. Rose.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that question, John. There is absolutely a new generation of people who are continuing this work. In 2018, the tribe created the Department of Cultural Affairs, which oversees the historical preservation work, as well as language and culture work. And there are really exciting efforts that have been happening, especially just in the last 5 years. Even, you know, there have been multiple things that have happened since the book was finished in 2021. And it's really exciting to see that kind of work happening. I'll just, you know, give a couple of quick examples. One of the most exciting things is, I think, language revitalization. The tribe is currently working with a linguist on revitalizing the Mohican language. This is a language that many people long thought was dead because the tribe has not been able to locate any kind of oral recordings of the language, but they are working now with a linguist and going back through archival materials to try to figure out how these words would have been pronounced, and they're succeeding. I mean, this language is coming back. People in the community are speaking the language. I was on the reservation 2 weeks ago for a historical committee meeting, and almost every person at that meeting introduced themselves in Mohican or Muncie. Mm. And so, you know, seeing that happen and the use of archival materials in that work is just really powerful. Oh. There's also just a ton of work going on in the Northeast. The tribe has a satellite historic preservation office in Massachusetts now. And so the there's just a ton of work out there related to, you know, walking trails and new museum exhibits and all kinds of things. So,
Rose, thank you for your scholarship. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great to be here.
Rose Myron, director of the Darcy McNichol Center for American Indian and Indigenous Studies at the Newberry Library, author of Indigenous Archival Activism, Mohican Interventions in Public History and Memory. WPR is a service of UW-Madison, which occupies ancestral Ho-Chunk land, a place their nation has called Dajope since time immemorial. UW-Madison respects the inherent sovereignty of the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with the 11 other First Nations of Wisconsin. At WPR, we remain committed to collaborating with First Nations to ensure that their stories and perspectives are authentically included and reflected in Wisconsin's public media landscape now and in the future. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.